This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we devote the entire show to the animal rights movement. Decades ago, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, raised public awareness of animal rights, paving the way for new animal justice movements. Our guests examine both the legal and activist perspectives of the modern-day animal welfare initiatives. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Discussions over whether animals are sentient beings, capable of feeling pain, pleasure, and suffering, date back as far as ancient thinkers such as Plutarch, Hippocrates, and Pythagoras. They all advocated for the fair treatment of animals. The term animal rights stands for the proposition that non-human animals have the right to be treated not as property, but rather as the individuals they are, with their own desires and their own needs. Animal law is now widely taught in law schools across North America. There are 167 law schools in the U.S. and Canada, and 11 in Australia and New Zealand, teaching courses in animal law. And several legal scholars have come out in favor of extending basic legal rights and personhood to non-human animals. Critics of animal rights argue that non-human animals are unable to enter into a social contract. For that reason, they posit, animals cannot have rights. Another argument is that animals may be used as resources as long as they don't undergo unnecessary suffering. And certain forms of animal rights activism, such as the destruction of fur farms and animal labs by the Animal Liberation Front, have also attracted criticism from the mainstream media and prompted congressional reaction by enacting harsh laws allowing these activities to be prosecuted as terrorism. These laws include the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. We'll be interviewing two guests today, attorney Tamara Bedick and activist Philip Murphy. We first talk with Tamara, chairperson of the National Lawyers Guild Animal Rights Committee. Tamara is a graduate of the University of Virginia School of Law. She has a master's from Columbia University and New York University and practices employment law with a focus on women and harassment in the workplace. Welcome, Tamara, to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Heidi. Thank you so much for having me today.
Tamara, I understand that nearly 200 law schools in the United States teach at least one course in animal law. Please tell our listeners, what is animal law?
Animal law is the combination of federal, state, and local laws, plus case law, that relates to or impacts non-human animals. So, for example, the Endangered Species Act of 1973 and last year's Preventing Animal Cruelty Act, those are federal laws. New York State has laws against dogfighting, for example, and last year New York City attempted to ban the sale of imported new fur coats. So federal, state, and local. The animal laws encompass companion animals, wildlife, and non-human animals used in research, in entertainment and sports, animals raised for food.
What kind of cases might a lawyer who specializes in this field represent?
Well, unless you're a lawyer for the Non-Human Rights Project, who have directly represented chimpanzees and most recently the solitary female elephant at the Bronx Zoo, most lawyers in animal rights fields are helping other humans to help animals. So, for example, the Animal Legal Defense Fund provides free legal assistance to prosecutors handling cruelty cases. On the civil side of things, you could be finding yourself assisting a human client to create a trust for their dog or for their parrot.
Let's talk briefly about the state of laws in the United States that already protect animal rights. What kind of animals now are covered?
Well, because laws can be local or state level, the field is a hodgepodge, quite frankly. So whereas New York State banned declawing of domestic cats last year, and some cities have banned declawing, for example, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Denver, declawing your companion animal is still legal in most of the U.S. But compare that to, say, California's 2004 statewide ban on declawing of all wild and exotic cats. So it's a real mishmash.
We've heard a lot about animal sentience. What is it, and what should our listeners know about it?
As our knowledge of anatomy and physiology improves, and as we begin to ask better and less anthropocentric questions, the more evidence we gather. And that evidence is converging and indicating that non-human animals have the neuroanatomical, neurochemical, and neurophysiological substrates of consciousness. They have intentionality, they recognize themselves in mirrors, they recognize each other, they use tools, they exhibit empathy. That's sentience.
Do they have feelings?
Yes, they do.
And they can suffer pain.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about terminology briefly. With the rise, especially of animal rights activism over the last couple of decades, at least in this country. For those of us who live with dogs, for example, is it wrong to call them pets?
Well, if you believe scientists and people like Lera Boroditsky, for example, that words shape the way you think. And if you are consciously trying to eliminate words that reinforce bias, then perhaps the word pet may not be how you want to experience your relationship with your dog. Along the same lines, a word I particularly despise is the word seafood. It suggests that fish have neither feeling nor purpose but to be killed and to be eaten.
I guess pet would imply property rather than an equal being.
Exactly.
Tamara, I understand that the European Union, for example, has enacted several laws over the years that acknowledge and protect animal rights. I'm curious about North America. How does this continent compare to other nations with respect to animal welfare?
I feel that other countries have surpassed us and that we are falling further behind. So, for example, if we compare the status of U.S. animal laws to, for example, the European Union, the thing that jumps out at us immediately is that the European Union laws create a single legal standard across all 26 European Union countries. Here, we have a state-by-state approach. So Maryland and Pennsylvania will restrict canine tail docking, and 9 states will regulate canine ear cropping, but not the others. And New York state laws have banned declawing, etc. It's haphazard. Meanwhile, the European Convention for Pet Protection, Article 3, states, quote, "No one shall cause a pet unnecessary pain, suffering, or distress," close quote. Full stop, boom. It covers declawing, tail docking, ear cropping. It covers all that in one fell swoop and across 26 countries. That's the difference. That's where we need to go.
Well, let's talk about the state that we're recording this show in, New York State. I've heard there's movement afoot to introduce laws banning puppy mills, but what laws have we passed already to protect non-human animals?
Well, in New York, you can't leave your dog in a locked car in extreme heat or cold. You can't leave them outside in extreme heat or cold. You can't pierce or tattoo your dog unless it's for identification. You can't declaw your cat anymore. You can't overdrive or overwork your horse. But yet, we had a 12-year-old mare Aisha collapsing multiple times in Central Park February 29th. Cockfighting and dogfighting, they're both illegal in New York. Yet December 6th, 2019, the NYPD busted a dogfighting ring and rescued 30 pit bulls, but Judge Melissa Jackson released all three suspects without bail. So we have some very good laws. The enforcement of those laws is still challenging.
Tamara, over the many years that I worked at the National Lawyers Guild, of which you are a member as well, we did a lot of work defending activists in the streets, in the courts. And I know that when I started in 1999, we didn't have many animal rights activists. Fortunately, that has changed over the years. I want to ask you, do you think animal rights and animal welfare activists have gotten a bad reputation in the public arena? And if so, how and why?
Well, America's political process has been usurped and corrupted by enormous corporations who pay off politicians who then write laws that support those donors. And in this framework, idealistic activists with little money or access to political power are shining a light in some of our darkest corners on behalf of sentient creatures with zero money and zero access to political power. Activists are the true underdogs here, but they're vilified by corporate money and by corporate interests.
Stalwart activist and writer who has been on Law and Disorder, Will Potter, who many listeners may remember runs a great website called Green is the New Red. He used to give presentations on how Wall Street, especially in the early 2000s and maybe the late 1990s, corporations, leaders would portray animal rights and environmental activists as terrorists wearing all black, wearing black masks. They had a lot of almost caricature characteristics, and they would go around law enforcement, and certain corporations would vilify animal rights activists. I want to ask you how you think these activists have raised awareness of and helped advance consciousness about animal welfare, despite these negative portrayals.
There have been a lot of undercover investigations, particularly Mercy for Animals, Direct Action Everywhere. Activists have stepped in to investigate on behalf of American consumers, I might add, how animals who are condemned to become our food, how those animals are living and what they're eating and the revolting, unsanitary conditions of their slaughter. Even if you're entirely utilitarian in your approach, hey, I don't want nasty bacteria in my food, you still deserve to know. You deserve to know. Don't you want to know what happened to that product that you're now putting in your mouth? Where has it been? So why is there zero transparency? Why the need to pass draconian laws in state after state that cloak food production in secrecy? Why ag-gag laws?
And that means agricultural gagging.
Gag law. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Ag-gag laws, so that listeners know a little bit more about what this means, are ways to criminalize undercover investigators, and that could be an ordinary citizen going into agricultural farms or places where animals are being raised in inhumane conditions or treated improperly, even tortured, to film them, produce videos and evidence to raise public awareness of inhumane conditions.
I think there was one case where a farm, I wish I remembered the name, but a farm actually sued someone who was traveling and who stopped on the road and took a picture of their friend in the car or in front of the car with the farm in the background. So this was considered a violation because the farm was in the background. Of course, it's entirely sealed off.
That reminds me of the anti-terrorism laws that also caught tourists or individuals, say, in New York City, taking photos of downtown Manhattan buildings and getting arrested for that.
Exactly.
Tamara, in 2005, the FBI declared both environmental activists and animal welfare activists as the nation's top domestic terrorism threat. Why was that?
Well, partially, I think, because the political climate allowed for use of words like terrorist. It had cachet. And the public was fearful enough to ignore infringement of someone else's rights in exchange for an illusion of greater security. Also, you have federal agencies, the CIA, the FBI, unable to find and bring Osama bin Laden to justice. So they look silly and ineffective despite their million-dollar budgets. Meanwhile, you have groups of 20-year-olds hugging trees. Now, if you label those 20-somethings domestic terrorists, you can confine them in CMUs and pat yourself on the back for a job well done.
In fact, we've had him on Law and Disorder years ago. Activist Daniel McGowan was arrested in part of what was called Operation Backfire around 2005 and 2006, a sweep of environmental activists. And Daniel was placed in a CMU, but wrote about his experience. And in fact, he was the subject of Will Potter's book, Green is the New Red, which we recommend people read if you haven't. A communication management unit is defined as a type of self-contained group within a facility in the U.S. Federal Bureau of Prisons that severely restricts, manages, and monitors all outside communication of inmates in that unit. We know that a lot of outspoken activists and persons deemed leaders of different movements have been placed in those units, or I should add, in solitary confinement across the nation. Tamara, you recently organized a panel at New York University Law School on the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. What is that?
The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act is a federal law passed without an actual vote and signed by President Bush. The real force pushing the bill, however, was the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, ALEC. And ALEC is a conglomerate of corporate interests, private sector representatives, and conservative state legislators. It's headquartered in Arlington, Virginia, and the corporate members of ALEC draft and share legislation, and then they distribute these model bills to their state legislators. So various conservative state legislators don't even have to draft their own legislation. They get the corporations to do it for them.
You know, years ago, many people hadn't heard of ALEC, but now it's received more attention in part because of their advisements, their amicus briefs on criminal justice, all sorts of issues that affect our economy, our laws, and our policies. I actually tried to join ALEC. I went online. I wanted to sort of, you know, monitor, but the fee to join, the membership fee, begins, I think, at $5,000. It was a little too hefty for my budget. Let's talk about the kinds of actions that prosecutors have brought under ADA.
Well, the best-known case was actually brought under the previous law, which was a softer, gentler ADA. It was the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, and it was brought against the Shack 7. The Shack 7 was a group of six animal rights activists, plus their computer, engaged in protected free speech behavior against an animal testing laboratory. And this became a landmark case because it showed how far the government will use terrorism rhetoric to silence free speech. There's a wonderful documentary detailing what happened, and that's Joaquin Phoenix's Animal People. It's available now on YouTube. It came out late last year, so I would recommend it to people. Subsequently, other animal activists have also been prosecuted on the federal level, and AETA was used against them as well, most notably the Johnson case, where Johnson and a companion freed 2,000 minks from a fur farm.
You mentioned six activists and their computer. The Shack 7, or let's say the Shack 6, ran an informational website that gave information about animal rights actions across the country.
That's right. And giving that information was criminalized.
Correct. They didn't actually, as I recall, urge people to attend. They just gave the information.
This is what's happening in so-and-so. This is what so-and-so is doing. Our branch in, you know, Spokane, Washington just did this. Exactly.
Right. And I think it's worth repeating the point that you made a few minutes ago about the government's failure or inability to catch so-called terrorists, that it's been an easy target to go after very vocal members of animal rights and environmental activists, especially when years ago they were, for the most part, unsuccessful in catching people who participated in the so-called underground movements like the Animal Liberation Front, Earth Liberation Front. So prosecutors then pursued lawful activists who were getting media attention and also those who were successful at what they did.
Exactly, like the Shack 7.
Yes.
So these were low-lying fruit, right? I mean,
exactly.
it was easy to get these people indicted and sentenced, and ultimately, you know, these people did time.
Yes, the Shack 7 all did time, and they were high-profile cases. So
right.
I think that serves the government's purpose of making them look successful.
And chilling other people from doing the same thing. This has an incredible chilling effect on people who want to go out and hand out leaflets. Handing out leaflets and chalking on the sidewalk is now criminalized behavior. And it's unfortunate that this is sweeping the country and it's affecting other groups beyond animal rights activists, beyond environmental activists. It's now affecting First Nations, Native Americans, Indigenous people. If you don't want a pipeline spoiling your water, you're facing criminal charges now. You're being criminalized for protesting.
That's a very good point. I'd also want to mention that ADA is drafted so broadly, and really the wording is so unclear. I remember when I was at the Guild, I used to get calls right after it was passed saying, we don't know if what we're doing is going to be criminalized. We need guidance. We need help. And as you say, that creates a chilling effect. People may opt not to go out to the streets and exercise their First Amendment rights for fear they're going to be prosecuted. If we may ask a personal question, Tamara, how did you first get involved in this issue of animal rights?
Peter Singer's book. I became a vegetarian in 1985, and I became politically active and a protester shortly thereafter. I didn't, however, become an animal rights activist until I found an abandoned pit bull who needed a home, and that was 2007. I named her Honey. And because of Honey, I met a fellow attorney and pit bull rescuer, John Marr. And it's thanks to Honey and John that I'm here today.
If listeners are interested in helping work on behalf of animals, what would you recommend?
Well, the first and hardest struggle is always against yourself and your own habits. So if you're interested in helping animals, don't eat them. Reject the violence that brought that flesh to your plate. Boycott that oppression. And encourage your friends to live healthy, cruelty-free lives. That's the best and first way.
On a more mundane note, you co-chair the Animal Rights Committee of the National Lawyers Guild.
Yes.
And that's, of course, for Lawyers Guild members. But if you could just give us an inkling of what kinds of things you do. You put on the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act panel. Anything else that listeners might want to hear about?
We meet once a month. We welcome not just lawyers, but law students and people who are working in law firms. You need to join the guild to join the Animal Rights Committee. And every month we focus on a slightly different issue within animal rights. So, for example, I'm currently supporting the New York Senate Bill S-4234, sponsored by State Senator Michael Giannaris. Assembly Member Linda Rosenthal is sponsoring a parallel bill in New York's Assembly. That's A-6298. And the fabulous thing about these bills is not only do they stop the deluge of puppy mill puppies from Jersey and Pennsylvania, but they also encourage pet stores to promote, feature, and showcase dogs, cats, and rabbits currently seeking forever homes. These adoptable friends deserve love and happiness, and pet stores are urged to cooperate with rescue groups to help that come about. So at the end of the month, we have legislative aides coming from a variety of different political officials, and they'll be addressing the committee on March 31st and helping us help them. How do we as a committee promote the passage of these bills, which will affect so many New York animals?
You know, I was happy to be one of the participants on your ADA panel, and in preparation for that, I did some
research. Thank you so much, Heidi. That was great. Thank you.
In preparation, I did some research, and one of the best sites that I found was the Animal Legal Defense Fund.
ALDF, yes.
ALDF, and they do so much wonderful work. I would encourage listeners to go to their site just to find out the kinds of laws that are being introduced all around the country, their successes, their challenges, what we're doing in your state as listeners, and of course, there are many other organizations.
And many schools have a student Animal Legal Defense Fund chapter. So if you're a student and if you're interested in animal issues, check out if your school or college, university, law school has an SALDF chapter and join that.
Great idea. Attorney Tamara Bedick, it's been a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. I want to applaud you for really the wonderful work you do on behalf of our fellow animals.
Thank you so much, Heidi.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
We're now joined by Philip Murphy in Philadelphia. Philip is a writer and social justice activist based in the greater New York City area. He's a co-founder of the Buddhist Action Coalition, NYC, and also a co-founder of the New York chapter of the UK-based Animal Rebellion, a global climate and animal justice movement. His recent article, Why Animal Justice is Crucial in Addressing the Climate Emergency, was published at the independent global media platform Open Democracy. Philip, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Heidi, thanks so much for having me on, and thank you for all the work you do on behalf of all sentient beings. We really appreciate it.
Philip, Animal Rebellion makes the link between animal rights and the climate and ecological emergency that we're facing. What is that link?
initially, animal rights are recognized as being intrinsic to animals being sentient beings, so that's kind of foundational. And the connection is made between the objectification of animals and their use for primarily for food, but also for clothing and entertainment and any other use, and the impact that that has on the degradation of the environment informing the climate crisis.
You mentioned sentient beings. You're speaking specifically of animals like human beings feeling pain and being more aware of feelings than I think we've recognized as a society.
That's correct. And the functional definition of sentience is the ability to suffer.
On a personal level, Philip, how did you get interested in these issues?
I came to the animal justice movement through my Buddhist meditation practice. In Buddhism, the teachings acknowledge that all sentient beings are members of the moral community and deserve moral consideration. So that was my introduction to animal justice.
On their website, Animal Rebellion says that it does not use traditional campaigning, but rather focuses on, quote, actions with higher political potential consequences. What does that mean? And can you give a few examples of the tactics that the group uses?
So foundationally, Animal Rebellion is invested in nonviolent direct action as a means to realize social change. Disrupting business as usual would be one way you could describe that, blocking streets and pathways to businesses that engage in animal agriculture, occupying spaces. There also is a path in this regard that's focused on what you could term happening. So co-opting the society of the spectacle, as Guy Debord talks about, by engaging in colorful, attention-grabbing marches and demonstrations. Famously in the UK, there was a vegetable dance party, and one of the characters, a Mr. Broccoli, subsequently became kind of a media sensation, was hosted on some of the morning programs in the UK. So that's another area, just using the spectacle of our, you know, contemporary society, the emphasis on spectacle, to raise awareness of animal rights and by extension, the impacts of animal, so-called animal agriculture on the climate catastrophe.
And just briefly, can you talk about that impact? Is it something like the release of gases that contributes to the climate change from so many animals being bred for farming?
Yes. In fact, what's most well known is the impact of greenhouse gas emissions on our climate degradation. And animal agriculture is the primary source of two of the main non-CO2 greenhouse gases, being methane and nitrous oxide, which are, in the near term, much more potent than CO2, in fact. So in addition to greenhouse gases, you also have highly unsustainable land use involved with so-called animal agriculture, deforestation, which leads to species extinction. You have air and water pollution, ocean acidification. All things considered, so-called animal agriculture is, in fact, the largest contributing factor to environmental degradation on the planet.
I want to ask you, in terms of the issue of animal sentience, which, as I understand it, is taking on in terms of researchers proving that animals can experience pain, for example. That issue, as well as the environmental impact that you mentioned, are both of those together part of the campaigning of Animal Rebellion, or is there a focus on one over the other?
No, in fact, it is both, and that's where Animal Rebellion is unique, and in fact, just briefly in terms of context, so Animal Rebellion is based on the demands and principles and values of Extinction Rebellion, which has become a global phenomenon as an environmental movement. there were members of Extinction Rebellion in the UK who were questioning the fact that animal agriculture was not being considered by Extinction Rebellion, which led to the formation of Animal Rebellion as kind of a member of what's become a larger group of movements, a movement of movements known as the Rebel Alliance.
I like that, the Rebel Alliance. Alex O'Connor, who's a popular YouTuber, has called the issue of animal exploitation a moral emergency. What does Alex mean by that?
I think primarily when one considers the fact that considers the scale of the violence visited on sentient beings, I mean, an estimated 72 billion land animals are, you know, commodified, hyper-confined, tortured, and killed for food in the world every year. And moreover, 2 to 2.7 trillion sea animals, marine animals, are also killed annually. And there's not a hard and fast number because it's done by weight, which is points to the commodification of sentient beings. The scope and scale and the magnitude of suffering is beyond comprehension. So that informs, I think, Alex O'Connor's characterization as a moral emergency. Moreover, it's the impacts, as I described, on the environment are just not acknowledged.
How important is the issue of veganism to this whole campaign? Is that something that Animal Rebellion educates people about?
Yes, in fact, it is. And by way of clarification, and this is kind of a commonly misunderstood meaning of veganism, it's not simply diet. It is a consistent inner oppression social justice stance. So it recognizes, to be consistent in taking an anti-oppression stance, that sentient beings, all sentient beings must be included, including non-human animals. So educating about that. Now, that said, the tentpole demand from an Animal Rebellion is, as a kind of starting point, is a plant-based food system. So that's front and center. The organization does very specifically adopt an anti-speciesist stance as well.
I haven't read Animal Liberation, but I understand that author Peter Singer writes that we tend to lump all animals together. We forget that humans are also animals. I would imagine that that distancing is one of the reasons that human beings continue to mistreat and use other animals.
Most certainly true. What comes to mind is a quotation, famous quotation from Voltaire, who said, "Those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities."
Does part of that include our refusal to acknowledge, for the most part, that animals are sentient beings?
It does. I mean, and that refusal is informed by, you know, just deep speciesist conditioning.
Thinking in a way that humans are superior than other animals.
This violence on a scope and scale that is truly, you know, mind-boggling. I would argue that on a spiritual level, the impacts of that violence are profound. And I had mentioned previously with regard to the environment, all things considered, all impacts of animal agriculture, it is the greatest impact. Negative impact on environmental integrity presently in our culture.
Listening to you speak about this, it resonates with me because I have seen videotapes of some of the ways that animals are mistreated and tortured. Many of our listeners may not have seen images of this. To them, it might sound like an abstraction, but I've got to tell you, researchers, and this is obviously a different field from food production, but researchers in laboratories literally punching little beagles in the face, holding animals down and punching them as they're trying to perform some experiment on them, that is torture. On Law and Disorder, we cover torture of human beings, extraordinary rendition, the illegality of that. How important do you think it is that people see those images to really understand what you are articulating?
I think the examples that you describe, Heidi, are important to raise awareness of the violence visited on other than human sentient beings, certainly. That said, I think it's equally as important from moving from that to look at the routinely violent behavior under what are considered by human beings to be humane practices, perhaps. There's nothing humane about commodifying, hyper-confining, torturing, and killing a sentient being. And those are intrinsic properties of standard practices in so-called animal agriculture. So, yes, it's important to kind of, as a way to get attention, it's intrinsically terrible, but the day-to-day violence visited on animals in animal agriculture, so-called animal agriculture, is really the issue here.
Excellent point. And I just quickly want to run through a couple of examples. In the poultry industry, I'm aware that one issue is the cramming of chickens into small spaces and cutting off their beaks.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they are debeaked, and it bears mentioning the reason that that's done is because they are social animals, and under this hyper-confinement, they go insane, and they begin to attack one another. That's part of the debeaking, but it's just horrible. It bears mentioning as well that a lot of people will have been exposed to what are marketing stances around free range. That's largely an industry way to circumvent horrible treatment. Free range can involve being access to an open space briefly. There's no right way to do the wrong thing, we're fond of saying in the animal justice movement. A really important point is that people will tend to, and this is culturally conditioned by the fact that, so-called vegetarianism, which is really a morally incoherent stance because it permits the, visiting violence on some animals and on others, is somehow kind of okay. It's more generally accepted in the culture. Veganism is considered more extreme. Dairy cows are the most abused animals on the face of the earth because their reproductive system is hijacked and they live longer. All of these other animals that are used for food, for their flesh as opposed to secretions, they're infants to adolescents in age relative to our lifetime. Dairy cows live 6 out of a normal lifetime, say 20. Years. They're annually, forcibly impregnated. They have 9 months, pregnancy, and then they give birth and the baby's taken away time after time, and they grieve like any human would grieve. So I just wanted to mention that, and while people might need a path, it may be a process, although it doesn't necessarily have to be to veganism, so-called vegetarianism is not a morally coherent, in and of itself, it's not a path. And many people, because of the cultural conditioning, have adopted that and said, and myself included, and I cringe when I think of the years that I called myself a vegetarian and didn't eat flesh, but, participated in the terrible violence of the egg and dairy industry.
And I appreciate that because I was going to actually ask you, and now you've made clear, I did not know that cows were made to have more offspring so that they would be lactating. That's a horrifying procedure. And then what happens to the babies? They're taken away and what's done with them?
Well, the males are put into crates, fed an iron-deficient diet so that their flesh remains weak. They're put in isolation hutches, and at 10 or 12 weeks, they're killed for veal.
Oh.
And the some of the females are, you know, allowed to grow into maturity so that they can replace their mothers on the dairy line. And it's just, it's dairy is the worst of all the things. And people say, you know, oh, well, it's not intuitive. And you just pointed to the fact, Heidi, it's so common, and myself included, before I got educated, which is that, well, you're not killing them necessarily. They're just, they have milk and there's an excess and we take some of it. It's like, no, they lactate because they're pregnant. The babies need to be taken away so that humans can take the milk. And these animals bellow for days or weeks. Imagine being a dairy cow, you're impregnated for the third time, and you know what's going to happen. I say this because it's just, it's so, you know, below the level of consciousness of people, because we're all busy people and we don't have time to think about everything. And the conditioning that we were born into a speciesist culture that says this is normal, natural, and necessary.
Are there any other parts of the industry that we should talk about? We have a few minutes remaining, but we've covered the milk industry, chickens, the animals that are raised just to slaughter. Is that declining because of more awareness in this country of how animals are mistreated?
In and of itself, it's indefensible. And I think one of the key points that can be made, and I think it's pretty significant, human beings are physiological frugivores. We don't need to eat animals to survive, unlike what are called obligate carnivores, like lions being the classic example. So people, there's this misconception that somehow we'll be nutritionally deficient if we don't eat animal products. And that's categorically untrue. The American Dietetic Association, their recommendation is that vegan diet is appropriate, nutritionally appropriate for all stages of life, including pregnancy. I speak to this because there's a misconception that human beings need to consume animal products, that we are, you know, we've adapted to be able to do so, but it makes us sick. We've never consumed animal products at the level we do now with factory farming. It used to be, you know, more occasional consumption, that kind of thing. So a foundational piece when I talk about this is, like, not only do we not need to consume animal products, the one kind of thing that people might point to is vitamin B12. We used to all get 12 from eating products that were less sanitized than they are now, including vegetables. So B12 is not produced by animals, but it's a source of B12 that vegans need to be aware of getting, you know, we'll supplement, because the fruit and vegetables that vegans eat are now so sanitized that the dirt in which the bacteria that produces B12 is washed away. Just mention that because that's one thing that people will talk to, you know, speak to is like, well, you need, what about B12, right?
Philip, can you talk very briefly about how the public perceives animal rights activists? Do you think there's been a softening of criticism over the last few years?
Yes, I do think that the public has, you know, come to realize that, to your point, using the term animal rights, actually, that animals do, you know, they are sentient beings. They have a unified psychological presence, and they do merit moral consideration. There has definitely been a raised awareness about that. Now, there's a long way to go, but there has been progress, certainly.
How can our listeners get involved with Animal Rebellion, those who live in New York City, if you've piqued their interest, which I hope you have?
Thank you. Yes. We maintain an active Facebook presence, so search for Animal Rebellion NYC. So please feel free to get in touch with us that way through Messenger. We also have an email access through start@arebellion.nyc. That's start at arebellion.nyc.
And we'll put a link to that on our webpage. We have to wrap this up now, Philip. It's really been a pleasure to talk to you about issues that I think many of our listeners take for granted and don't think about. So I wish you the best of luck out there in the streets, and thank you for your important work.
Thank you for having me on, Heidi. I really appreciate it. Thank you for all your great work. Your support for our work is invaluable and deeply appreciated.
Please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Law and Disorder has been broadcasting for nearly 13 years now. We started on WBAI in New York City and are now carried on nearly 100 affiliate stations across the country. We'd like to take a moment to thank them.
WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. KRFP 90.3 FM, Radio Free Moscow, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN 107.5 FM, Nashville, Tennessee. KSOW 106.7 FM, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP 101.7 FM, Clay, West Virginia.
KRFC 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD 90.7 FM, Kasilof. 104.5 FM Radio, Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJLP, 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIF-FM, 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. WPVM, 103.9 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago. Motion Community House Radio, online.
WLRI 92.9 FM, Gap, Pennsylvania. WPRR 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS 102.1 FM, Columbus Community Radio. 98.3 FM, Central Ohio. KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, WSLR-FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida, KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Around Radio, Lorain Community College Radio, WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut,
WJFF Radio Catskill 90.5 FM, WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin.
That's where I used to go fishing with Michael Ratner.
WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine, 99.9 FM, Bangor, Maine, Redwood Community Radio.
KMUD 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. KMUE 88.3 FM, Eureka, California. KLAI 90.3 FM, Laytonville, California. Voice of Sacramento 88.7 FM, Sacramento Community Radio.
WWPM MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois. Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass., where I grew up. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass., where I did three semesters.
You dropped out.
KSER FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington. WCRS, LPFM, 98.3 FM and 102.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ 94.9 FM, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU 90.7 FM.
WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR 91.7 FM, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3 FM and 89.9 FM, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, The Eye, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Massachusetts. WFTE, 90.3 FM and 105.7 FM, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. Rochester Free Radio, WRFI 91.9 FM, Watkins Glen. WINO, 89.9 FM, Odessa, and 88.1 FM, Ithaca, New York. WEFT, 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, online community radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio, Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes. KAOS 89.3 FM, Olympia, Washington. KWTF, Sonoma County, California.
Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas. KBOO 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM, Hood River. WSCA 106.1 FM, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. WZRD 88.3 FM, Chicago, Illinois.
KOWA 106.5 FM, Olympia, Washington. WRIR 97.3, Richmond, Virginia. KMEC 105.1 FM, Ukiah, California. KSVU 90.1 FM, Concrete, Washington. WXPI 88.5 FM, Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
KNSJ 89.1 FM, San Diego, California. KGHI 91.1 FM, Westport, Washington. Our Streaming Planet podcast. WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C. KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas. 89.7 FM, Huntsville, Texas. 89.5 FM, Galveston, Texas. WOOL FM, 91.5 FM, Bellow Falls, Vermont. Black Sheep Radio.
KGIG 104.9 FM, Salida, California. KEUL 88.9 FM, Girdwood, Alaska. KRDILP 103.1 FM, Duval, Washington. WUMD 89.3 FM, University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. KWRKLP 90.9 FM, Alaska Peace Center, Fairbanks, Alaska.
WGRNLP 94.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York. WHYR LP 96.9 FM, Baton Rouge Community Radio, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Workforce Rising Online.